This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Hello. Welcome to Illinois Radio Reader. This is Lisa bringing you the News Gazette on this Wednesday, May the 1st, 2024. Let's start with the local news on the front page. In the center of the page, we have nine pictures of people who have won from the Urbana Schools Foundation recognition. Star quality. The stars will be out tonight at Riggs Beer Company in Urbana, site of Champaign-Urbana's Schools Foundation annual Spring Fling. Set to be saluted are nine teachers who will receive $250 cash and a $250 classroom grant with their Shining Star Awards, and nine support staffers and paraprofessionals who will be given $250 and a thank you with their Superstar Honors. And then they go on to introduce each of the teachers and the recipients that have won this acknowledgement. But let's go on with another article. Central Illinois Multimedia Group. From Champaign by Jana Wiersema. FCC okays acquisition of Decatur, Danville stations. Champaign Multimedia Group has completed its acquisition of eight downstate radio stations and is changing its name to Central Illinois Multimedia Group to mark its expansion. CIMG previously announced in February that it had reached a deal with Neuhoff Communications to acquire three stations in Danville and five in Decatur. The FCC approved the deal Thursday. CIMG Vice President Grant Thompson said, "We're going from three radio stations that are primarily Champaign-Urbana, Champaign County area, and we're adding three in Vermilion County and five in Macon County," he said. So it's 11 brands across a really vast area and the ability to offer marketing solutions to advertisers throughout Central Illinois, he said. The acquisition includes WDNL-FM, WRHK-FM, and WDAN-AM in Danville, as well as Decatur's WSOY-FM, WDZQ-FM, WSOY-AM, WDZAM, and WCZQ-FM. The latter station will be heard in both Champaign and Decatur. The deal also includes the website, nowdecatur.com, and vermilioncountyfirst.com. CIMG is family-owned affiliate of Community Media Group, which is based in West Frankfort. In addition to the News Gazette and the CIMG's other products, Community Media Group operates newspapers, magazines, shoppers, and radio stations in several Midwestern states, including Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, and Michigan, as well as New York and Pennsylvania. We're honored to have the opportunity to join with managers and staff of these stations and their digital websites in continuing the Neuhoff tradition of creative local programming, content, and service to Danville, Decatur, and Central Illinois region, Community Media Group Chairman Larry Parado said. With its new acquisitions, they will reach and expand to 24 counties in Illinois and 5 in Indiana via 11 over-the-air signals. And an article from Champaign by Jeff D'Alessio entitled, "Regional Officials Stuck with Decision on Filling Vacancies. Lewis will take over this Monday for the Champaign School Board." Why would anyone want to apply for a seat on a Champaign school board that's been described as toxic, dysfunctional, and combative by its own current and former members? I think the numbers in some ways speak for themselves, Board President Giannina Baker told the News Gazette on Tuesday night. You wouldn't think the way it's been described that way. We've had 26 applicants for two seats in April. There's something that's motivating people to apply, their own personal agenda or their frustrations. Or they want to see stability. The saga that has been the Champaign School Board since two members resigned in frustration 2 weeks apart in March is about to enter a new phase, a do-over in the effort to find replacements for Jamar Brown and Mark Thies. As was expected and is mandated by state statute, Regional Superintendent of Schools Gary Lewis, not the five remaining members of the Unit 4 Board, will assume control of the process starting Monday, which will mark 60 days since Brown stepped away. 13 days later, assuming there's no change in the board divide that led to the process being outsourced, Lewis and members of the yet-to-be-announced panel would open the search for Thies' successor. Baker said Lewis checked in Tuesday, but he won't take official action until next week. Just like the last time, anyone will be able to apply and be considered for one of the two openings that expire in April of 2025. As long as they meet three requirements, they are at least 18 years old, a registered voter, and a resident of the district for at least 1 year. What the process and timeline look like beyond that remains to be determined. Lewis has said it will likely begin with a call-out for applicants to submit a letter of interest. What is known is that none of the five current school board members will be picking who sits next to them at meetings. A last-ditch Monday effort by Baker to schedule a Wednesday meeting to choose new members was scrapped Tuesday after Amy Armstrong and Betsy Holder said they wouldn't take part in the process and preferred that Lewis make those calls. They did likewise on April 9th, leaving the board without the quorum needed to hold an official meeting. Both said they objected to the process of trimming the list from 26 to 11, one in which every member chose three candidates. Armstrong and Holder said they favored a ranking system that would have included alternate choices should someone drop out, as one candidate invited to interview immediately did. In calling off today's meeting, Baker expressed frustration with Armstrong and Holder, calling their behavior adventurous and in violation of the board's code of conduct. In a statement issued through the district's communication chief, Baker said in part, "I have tried to stay the course when others continue to move goalposts. For example, I find that a board member's attempt to possible resolution to the process to be performative and disingenuous when they had no intent on participating in a meeting. Their behavior will result in the intended outcome, to have ROE's Gary Lewis and his committee select our new colleagues. Some may call it a win. I see it for what it is." Continuing in our county, by Samuel Lisek from Urbana, February 8th fatal shooting, psychiatrist suspect insane at the time of crime. Second evaluation of Shimanga ordered Tuesday to determine how his murder trial will proceed. A court-appointed psychiatrist determined this month that the Urbana man charged with fatally shooting the manager of a downtown Champagne bar earlier this year was insane when he allegedly pulled the trigger. The professional opinion delivered by the county's lead forensic psychiatrist, Dr. Lawrence Jekyll, opens the possibility that Fidel G. Tsingmanga, 25, will be found not guilty by reasons of insanity in the February 17th death of Brandon Hardaway. Mr. Hardaway, manager of Poor Brothers Craft Tap Room, was outside the bar on February 8th when Tsingmanga approached him and shot him at point-blank range with a firearm that was stolen out of a parked car in Savoy 3 months prior, state's attorney Julia Reitz previously said. Hardaway was taken to an area hospital and died about a week later, leading Reitz to file charges of first-degree murder against Tsingmanga on February 21st. Jekyll determined that Tsingmanga is mentally fit to stand trial, a legal condition that indicates he's able to understand the nature of the court proceedings and assist his attorney, Chief Public Defender Elizabeth Pollock, in his defense. But insanity differs from fitness and is determined retroactively if a defendant shows they could not substantially appreciate the criminality of their conduct during the time they committed an offense. In Champaign County, the two evaluations are often ordered together. On Tuesday, Judge Randy Rosenbaum granted a motion from Assistant State's Attorney Scott Larson for Tsingmanga to be evaluated by a second forensic psychiatrist from Springfield. The court will consider the second opinion at a June 26th hearing. If the second psychiatrist disagrees with Jekyll's evaluation and finds that Tsingmanga was not insane when he allegedly shot Mr. Hardaway, the case will proceed to trial on whether Tsingmanga was able to appreciate the criminality of his conduct that day. It is an important case, and we will want to make sure we're not missing anything before we move ahead, Larson said after the hearing. When Judge Brett Olmstead ruled February 14th that Tsingmanga must be held in jail ahead of his trial, he cited evidence that indicated Tsingmanga was suffering under delusions leading up to the shooting. Tsamanga allegedly admitted to police after he was arrested that he smashed a woman's phone on February 5th in the Illinois Terminal in downtown Champaign because he thought she was talking about him and that people were spreading things about him on their phones. He also brandished a gun at the woman's 13-year-old son, Reed said. If found not guilty by reason of insanity, Tsamanga will be evaluated by the Illinois Department of Human Services and transferred to a state forensic hospital for treatment. If Tsamanga is found to have not been insane and is convicted of first-degree murder, he faces 20 to 60 years in prison. Fidel Tsamanga is in arraignment hearing on the screen at Champaign County Courthouse in Urbana on Monday. In Urbana, by Luke Taylor, an article entitled University of Illinois, Jewish students, community members gathered nearby during third day of pro-hostility, Palestinian encampment, As protesters calling for University of Illinois to divest from all ties to Israel continued their third day of camping on Main Quad, around 100 students and community members with ties to Jewish organizations celebrated their heritage by the alma mater statue. Ben Shapiro, student president of Illini Hillel, said the gathering was not intended as a counter-protest. I want to clarify that this is a gathering to show Jewish pride and to show that we're not going to be scared, he said. There's this feeling that Jewish students aren't welcome on this campus. Jewish students are scared to leave their homes. They're scared to go to class. We're not necessarily addressing anything else happening on campus. We're showing that the Jewish community exists. Shapiro was one of 26 signatures on an email sent Monday to U of I Chancellor Robert Jones and President Tim Colleen informing them of plans for the gathering. The email also said, "We call on the university to uphold their policies, hold those who violate them accountable, and remove the encampment at the heart of our campus, the Main Quad, as soon as possible." While Shapiro said he had not seen a response to that email from university administration, he emphasized that his organization intended to work with administration and wanted to avoid sinking to the level of the pro-Palestinian demonstrators by breaking any university policies. "We want them to do what's right and uphold their policies," he said. Associate Chancellor and spokeswoman, Robin Kaler, watched the gathering from a distance. She said the Jewish organization did step outside of university guidelines by setting up tables and playing loud music, and that the U of I intended to enforce policies as appropriate to all students, whether in the encampment or elsewhere. "A university is a place where you learn and grow and figure out how to navigate the world, right? We're trying to help people do that," Kaler said. "These are grown-ups, and they make decisions. And yes, there can be consequences to their actions." Some of the attendees at the Jewish Pride celebration made their way to the Main Quad afterward and observed the encampment. Encampment spokespersons are not providing their names to the media because of concerns about security. One who identified herself as an encampment organizer said the group saw no reason to respond directly to Tuesday's gathering near the alma mater. "We as a community here, we don't have any quarrels with people who are Jewish," she said. "We have a problem with Zionism." She also said that Jewish students should not feel unsafe around the encampment. "We do have some Jewish students here in the encampment, so we haven't posed any threat to them," she said. "We haven't responded with any counter-protesters on our end. We're here as peaceful protesters." Tents were originally placed on the lawn near the alma mater statue on Friday, resulting in two arrests and extended negotiations between organizers and U of I administration. Demonstrators cleared the area around midnight. More tents were placed on the Main Quad on Sunday afternoon, forming an encampment that has continued through Tuesday. Demonstrators have stayed overnight in the tents and hosted events throughout the day, including de-arrest and de-escalation training, as well as teach-in sessions from graduate students. In a photograph, a demonstrator holds a large Palestinian flag as he looks over the pro-Palestinian encampment Sunday on the Main Quad at the University of Illinois campus in Urbana. And another photo showing Ben Shapiro, student president of Illini Hillel, speaking to students and community members affiliated with several Jewish organizations who gathered nearby at the alma mater statue on Tuesday in Urbana. another article from Urbana by Jana Wiersema. Property tax dispute. County asks High Court to reconsider hearing Carl case. Champaign County officials have made another plea to the Illinois Supreme Court to consider a long-running legal dispute between Carl Health and local and state taxing bodies. This court's review is necessary to prevent entities that perform only incidental amounts of charity from shifting their tax obligations onto local residents and businesses to avoid new court litigation regarding exemption claims that should be resolved administratively in the first instance, and to resolve growing uncertainty in this area of the law, county officials wrote in their motion for reconsideration. The state high court previously announced in late March that it had denied Champaign County and the Illinois Department of Revenue's appeal of an appellate court decision regarding property tax exemptions for Carl. However, court officials said that in the event of a denial, the party or parties who submitted the appeal can ask the court to reconsider its decision by filing a motion or leave to file a motion for reconsideration, as well as a motion for reconsideration. Stephen Flom, one of Carl's Chicago lawyers, said that the health system has no comment on the county's motions. The 4th District Appellate Court previously issued a decision in August to uphold 7 years' worth of charitable tax exemptions for Carl, and also ruled that Carl was entitled to an exemption for an 8th year. Prior to that, Champaign County Judge Randy Rosenbaum ruled that in 2020, Carl was entitled to partial exemptions on its 4 Urbana properties for tax years 2005 to 11. Rosenbaum said there was insufficient evidence to determine the amount of the hospital's charitable activities for 2004. The appellate court later reversed the decision for that year while upholding its determination for the others. The county and state revenue department appealed the case to the Illinois Supreme Court in December. County officials argued in their latest filing that the court should take up the case to address ways in which sections of the Illinois Constitution and state law were interpreted by both Carl and the 4th District. In addition to the case in question, Champaign County is involved in similar litigation brought by OSF Healthcare and another suit from Carl. These cases are being stayed pending the outcome of the matter at hand, county officials wrote. The county estimates about $19 million is at stake for impacted taxing districts. And an opinion article by Jim Dye entitled, Appeals Court Rules A Rose by Any Other Name Would Not Pass the Sniff Test. What's in a name? Juliet raised the philosophical question in William Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, the bard's classic about the two star-crossed lovers caught up in the middle of the famous feud between two families, the Montagues and the Capulets. What's in a name? That which we call a rose by any other name would smell as sweet, she ponders. Well, that's one way of looking at it, considering the same question involving a much more practical issue. A Chicago federal appeals court concluded that names matter in civil litigation and should be withheld under only the most special of circumstances. Why should a plaintiff be able to shield himself from public knowledge of his acts when throwing a harsh light on identified defendants? If there should be a difference, it ought to run the other way. As plaintiffs enjoy an absolute privilege against claims of defamation for what they say in their complaints and briefs, Appellate Justice Frank Easterbrook recently wrote for a unanimous 3-judge panel. The ruling stems from a lawsuit filed by John Doe. His identification for the moment against Indiana University, alleging U of I violated his rights when it suspended him from medical school for 1 year. The suspension grew out of a physical dispute between Doe and a female U of I student that occurred off campus. The incident's locale raised but did not resolve an issue as to whether the university's disciplinary process has any jurisdiction in those kinds of cases. Easterbrook wrote that there is some doubt about how, if at all, Title IX applies to student against student misconduct that appears to be unrelated to a university or its facilities. But he said, this case does not require the court to address the issue. University disciplinary officials who too often assert vast jurisdiction and abuse their authority ought to keep that issue in mind. In this case, Doe alleged the university discriminated against him because he's a male who was caught up in an anti-male disciplinary process. While acknowledging the university overstepped its bounds in its disciplinary action against Doe, the court said that in this case, U of I did not discriminate against him because of his sex. Easterbrook wrote, "The training materials that the trial judge examined support a conclusion that the university's personnel were trained to favor complainants, most of whom are women." But he said that the inherent institutional bias can't be described as sex discrimination by the U of I. Ultimately, the judge's decision to send the case back to the trial judge, but with a caveat. If Doe elects to continue with the suit, his true name must be disclosed to the public. If Doe elects not to reveal his name, the complaint must be dismissed, Easterbrook wrote. The law that requires a legal complaint must name all parties, but there are limited exceptions. Minors are identified by their initials. Those who credibly argue they will be physically harmed or retaliated against can obtain anonymity. That adverse reaction, however, must be beyond the reasonable reaction legitimately attached to the truth of the events as determined in court. Because mere embarrassment doesn't cut it, the appeals court ruled the trial judge erred when he granted Doe, anonymity based on how others might view him. Title IX litigation is not an exception to the norm that adult litigants are identified by name, Easterbrook wrote. In other words, a litigant identified by any name other than his own almost always would leave a foul odor in the courtroom. And still in our county, on Wednesdays and continuing through harvest season, the News Gazette's Dave Hinton will spotlight a farm family of the week. The best way to raise a family. You can't beat the togetherness of working side by side, being out in the sunshine, learning what life has to teach for raising a family. That's why the Decker family says growing up and living on a farm is the best way. Having them on the farm with us daily is a blessing, Ed Decker said, of his children and grandchildren. He answers the questions in this first installment of the 2024 season for our long-running series. How long has your family been farming? Brothers Ed and Ken and Ed's son Nick run the farm operation. We are fortunate to have two centennial farms. One is from Ed and Ken's 98-year-old father Alvin near Philo, and the other is from their late mother Ethel's family near Ivesdale. Nick is the fifth generation to farm from our family. Where is the farm? We farm near Philo, but also in the Sadorus, Pisotum, Tolono, and Longview areas. How and why did your family come to this area and from where? Alvin's family moved here from Indiana back in the early 1900s. We are of German and Irish descent. What does your family operation consist of? We grow corn and soybeans. The majority of our acres are under contract for seed bean production and food-grade yellow and white corn. Kim also runs about 40 Angus cows. Nick finishes out with a few head of steers for freezer beef as well. How many people in the family does the farm support? Ed and Ken have been farming together for many years. Ed's oldest son, Nick, had joined the operation, so all three families, along with Alvin, are supported by our operation. Ken's daughter, Veronica, also provides labor in the spring and fall. Are any family members working other jobs? Nick's wife, Ashley, works for the University of Illinois. Ken's wife, Janet, works for the village of Philo, and Kim did all of the dispatching and most of the paperwork for Ed's trucking company until we retired from that in 2018. Have you seen farming change over the years? This is probably everyone's response, but it's technology. It is amazing to think that Alvin was farming with horses, and now we have autonomous field equipment. It makes us wonder what our grandchildren might see. It's nice to have Nick coming up who is in the new technology and can implement it. Your farm equipment, green, John Deere, red, Case IH, or other? Over the years, we've owned many different colors. We have a couple white tractors called Versatile. John Deere combines and hay tractor, Case planter and tractors. We run what is most cost-effective for our operation. What makes farming such a good vocation? I think we would all agree it's the best way to raise a family. Whether it's a child or a grandchild who can't wait to ride in a tractor or combine, or come out to pet the cows or new babies, and having them on the farm with us daily is a blessing. The sunshine and fresh air are good for the soul. There are so many life lessons we're able to teach our kids and grandchildren while out on the farm. It's also wonderful for Ed and Ken to farm with their father for so many years. What's the best time of year to be on the farm? Some love the spring with the new beginnings of plants and animals. The boys tend to love the fall, to see the fruits of our labor. Most days on the farm, there's something positive happening or a life lesson to be learned. What other activities is your family involved in? We're so blessed to have so many generations who have been able to farm. Nick's is the fifth generation. Our family has been a part of St. Thomas Church in Philo our whole lives, and Alvin attended St. Joseph Academy before it became St. Thomas. Alvin's children and most of his grandchildren have attended St. Thomas School as well. The boys are or have been members of the Philo Fire Department and Drainage Districts in our district. And there's a lovely picture of the Decker family at the bottom. In Vermilion County, by Dave Hinton, Danville, survey aims to identify rural areas lacking internet access. In the 1930s, many Americans on the farm had the benefit of lots of sunshine and being their own boss, but things were generally more difficult than for their urban counterparts. One reason? A lack of electrical service. The rural region back then was a power desert. That began to change when Congress passed the Rural Electrification Act in 1936, which allowed the federal government to make low-cost loans to farmers who then formed cooperatives to bring electricity to rural America. Nearly 90 years later, many rural areas are part of a different kind of desert, the digital desert. State and federal officials have sought ways to make it bloom as well. They want to bring reliable internet service to more people living outside municipalities. While some might consider internet service a luxury, many consider it a necessity to do their jobs. Farmers have always been small businessmen. We've just never looked at them that way, said Tom Frick from Vermilion County Farm Bureau. More and more farmers are relying or attempting to rely on the internet for their jobs. Thus, a meeting was held last week outlined the effort to bring broadband internet service to all of Vermilion County. Vermilion Advantage CEO Mike Marin, himself a farmer and former state representative, said the meeting was held to spread the word to get people to respond to a survey seeking input to determine where there were holes in the system for internet service. Those who wish to respond can go to VermilionAdvantage.com or submit paper copies to the Vermilion Advantage office. County residents can also respond to the survey on the Farm Bureau's website at vcfb.info, or they can stop by the Bureau's office. Bill Coleman, a representative of Illinois Broadband Breakthrough Initiative, has been touring counties to encourage people to complete the survey. The people at the state level wanted to meet the local broadband team, Marin said. We put together some interested stakeholders such as the Sheriff's Department, Vermilion County Farm Bureau, Vermilion County Government, Danville Area Community College, the Regional Office of Education, and headed by Vermilion Advantage. It won't be an overnight fix, said Marin, calling it a lengthy process. It also won't be an inexpensive proposition. Rural homes are spread out, so stringing fiber optic cable from homesteads several miles apart might not be feasible. Frick said some rural residents use satellite-based internet providers such as Starlink, while others use cell phones as hotspots. There are downsides to both. Satellite service often suffers from high latency, i.e. longer response times because of the distance signals must travel, and cell phone data can be costly. Also, some parts of Vermilion County don't have good cell service, Frick said. Marin said the federal funding that will be available will come through the state to encourage broadband providers to invest providing reliable internet service in several counties, an application process that could start this summer. This grant helps you walk through that, he said. Actually, we're putting the criteria in place to vet ISP providers. Marin estimates a good half or more of Vermilion County has limited internet access, and some other parts of the county have only one provider. Let's take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the News Gazette, May 1st. Please stay tuned.